Well, a lot of football fans didn't get much sleep last night because of that incredible Super Bowl game, which just turned everything around. If you were into football, you're sure you watched it and understood that. I didn't get much sleep last night for a totally different reason. I just had a lot of gas.
Ron Van Dam is an experienced talk show host. Do not attempt to try this at home.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
Welcome to the Ron Van Dam Show. Hold on tight. Things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure, why not?
Whatever.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show in color.
Sit back, relax, grab a cup of coffee, a cup of tea, whatever your liquid libation may be in the morning, and join us as we take a look at the world around us. As much as it's a pleasure to be with you, the pleasure is actually all yours. And now, here's your host, Ron Van Dam.
Thank you so much. Can I get you anything? Would you like something to drink? Would you like a cocktail? Would you like a beverage? Do you need some type of arthritis medication? I can take care of you. Come here, sit down, why don't you? Let me rub your back in a sexual manner. No, not you, her. Welcome to the program, I'm Ron Vadeo. How you doing? Good to be yesterday was the Super Bowl, duh. And it was quite a performance. As a matter of fact, whether you were a fan of the Patriots or the Falcons, which apparently were the two teams playing, It was quite a game. It was the largest comeback by a team, thus being the Patriots, ever in Super Bowl history. It was the first time in the Super Bowl history that they ever went into overtime. First time any quarterback their coach, have ever won five Super Bowl titles. There were a lot of firsts last night. I was the first person in my house to go to bed. That was a first. For me, I mean, you know. Anyway, hi, how you doing today? Good for you. To be honest with you, I'm a Patriots fan because I live in the New England area and it's the law. You have to be. It's stamped on your birth certificate that if you ever move to the Boston area, you must be a Patriots fan. It just says that. I can show it to you. It's not true, but of course it's in practice the case. The same as if you live in the Atlanta area, you must support the Falcons, I suppose. I don't know if the rest of the country really cared so much. I really have no idea really whatsoever. Some people watch the Super Bowl just for the commercials, which is probably the oddest thing I've ever seen in my life. It's the largest, it's a big sporting event. People go crazy about it. They celebrate it for 2 weeks. They get it. It's all they talk about. And yet, the major lure for many is the commercials. I don't know who you are. I simply don't know who you are. Halftime show was Lady Gaga. I wish she changed her name to whatever it is. I have trouble saying Lady Gaga. I sound like I'm playing with my granddaughter.
You want to come to Papa Gaga Gaga?
Oh, come on, get a name. Get a name. Choose one. Go through a book, choose a nice name, and stick with it. I'm tired of this baby talk. Lady Gaga, Google. What is this? What have we reverted to here, all this baby crap here? Anyway, she apparently gave an interesting performance. Some people think it was a bit political. obviously, if you're a Trump supporter or Trump himself, you will find that everything probably has hidden stuff against you. You just wait, ladies and gentlemen who support Donald Trump. You think this is paranoia now? You wait and see. The numbers of people against you grow. Donald Trump supporter was a Tom Brady, apparently. Doesn't say whether he voted for Trump or not, but Brady, quarterback Brady, and Trump are friends. I probably had sex, because Trump can have sex with anything he wants. He probably touched Brady's pussy quite a few times. And Coach Belichick, coach of the Patriots, he actually went immediately to Trump Tower as soon as Trump won to congratulate him, because they're old buddies. So in a way, in the back of my political mind, I was hoping the Patriots would not win just to teach them a damn lesson. But then I realized you've got to separate politics from your life in that situation, otherwise not necessarily. But no, it was an interesting game. It was just something. I don't talk football because I dislike football in a sense. Now don't get me wrong here. Don't gang up on me and start beating the crap out of me. I dislike football for one reason and one reason only, and that is it's just ridiculously a stupid game. Those that play football knowingly, at least at this juncture, you're playing football knowing that you will be destroying your body physically. The idea of football is to stop the other guy from doing stuff by knocking him down, headbutting him, just making him fly in the air till he hits the ground. Disable the other guy. Disable the other guy. Don't kill him, but knock him down to his feet. Cut his feet off. And make him fly through the air and slam into a wall. It's the most violent sport, probably, other than bullfighting, for the bull. They wear a lot of gear, and I know that, and that's a great excuse. There was a movie called Concussion, showing the evils of football and how it basically changes a person's brain pattern. They'll undergo physical operations probably for the rest of their life. But these football players, they get into it, because their parents tell them that. I'll tell you a story. By the way, I have nothing against football now, because now that all the players are aware of the extreme dangers and destruction and abuse of their own bodies and their own brains, that now I just have to say, okay, apparently you're sacrificing your life for my entertainment purposes. At least we're on the same page. That's fine, as long as you know what's going on here. I know you make oodles and oodles of money. As long as you want to trade that off for the rest of your life, and you want the fame, and you want your ego inflated and your fame and all that kind of stuff, and you're willing to sacrifice your entire body in every way, shape, or form, go for it, and go for it. Fine. I had a neighbor years ago, and he had a young boy. And the boy was about, I guess, 8 years old. And like a good father, State Farm was there. Like a good father, this guy took his kid to his lawn there, his side property. And they would play baseball. The father would toss baseballs to his kid. And his kid would stand there in front of a little thing. And he would have his bat in his hand. And the little kid would swing at the baseballs. And sometimes he would hit the baseballs and sometimes not. And the father was playing with his son. And that's a very American, typical male thing to do with your son, is to toss baseball at them, and they hit it with a bat as best they can. Well, they did this maybe once a week on a Saturday. And it was a pretty day, and I had my window open, and I could hear them. And he says to his kid, and I don't blame him. I mean, this is the way Americans are brought up. American men, American boys. And they're playing, and the kid's just not hitting any balls today. He's just swinging and missing. And the father says to his kid, not in a yelling manner, but in a very manufactured manner, and a matter-of-fact manner as well. He says to his kid, as he's tossing the balls, and his kid's not hitting the balls, he's saying, "Hey, Johnny, If you don't hit these balls and practice more, you're never going to become a professional ball player. And the discussion was how little Johnny, if he doesn't do better hitting this ball, he'll never become a professional ball player. It didn't bother me because I don't give a shit, but it was very demonstrative of what's actually going on here. This kid, this 8-year-old kid, is being set up in his mind that if he really practices hard, he will become a professional ball player. The chances of that are so nil, it's not funny. Yeah, it's possible, but believe me, little Johnny, who can't hit balls, certainly he's not going to become a professional ball player ever. Ron, don't say that. That's dashing a kid's dreams. No, it's building a kid's dreams up to something he will never become. And I felt a little, I don't know, I just didn't feel very proud of this thing. I'm sure little Johnny grew out of it, realizing he's not going to be a professional ball player, but it was just interesting how some fathers actually set their kids up to feel like that they could be. And they're probably doing it for an altruistic reason. You know, maybe little Johnny, you can be a baseball player someday. But we all know, Johnny, you can't, because you can't even hit the ball. So, but this is a male thing. I don't know if it's the testosterone or the urine going crazy or Lipitor. I have no idea why a man must insist that his child be a professional sports person simply because they're playing around with a ball. I mean, I don't. I guess it's part of it. I guess it's like a woman playing with her dolls. When she's like 5-6 years old, playing with her dolls in a dollhouse or something, and she wants to be a mother someday or something like that. I guess it's a kid shooting too high. Now, the kid who wants to be a mother playing in a dollhouse, that's a very big possibility. The kid standing in the side yard of his house with his father, chances of swinging a ball that he never hits, probably won't be a professional ball player. So I guess that's not a parallel, but I just found that fascinating and I decided I wanted to waste your time for about 10 minutes. So I went in that direction. I apologize to you. The New England Patriots, I never talk about sports because it scares me, because as soon as I start talking about sports in a very serious manner, I catch myself and I say, oh, wait a minute. It's a game. Don't get sucked into this thing. Don't get sucked into something that really is it's a game. It's an entertainment thing. Don't get hot and bothered, and don't argue with people about players, because that's getting a little weird now. separate entertainment and fantasy from your real life. Come on. Anyway, I've always said, whenever I talk about football with anybody, and that's extremely rare, I've always said, I'm not a sports expert, I'm just kind of observant. The New England Patriots, if you follow football, the New England Patriots only play as well as they have to, unless the other team really sucks and you can't help but slaughter them points-wise. But the New England Patriots have one problem, and I think it's a coaching thing. They only play as well as they have to. The first half of the Super Bowl, the Patriots were just playing horribly, and the Falcons were playing wonderfully. And then it started to turn around, because you can't play wonderfully like forever. And the Patriots were able to come back from a 25-point deficit, which is the largest deficit in the Super Bowl that any team had come back from, and then actually won on top of that. That's amazing, yes, but it's only because the Patriots are a fairly good football team, but they only play as well as they have to. Not to say they don't always play well, but when they're in a down situation, that's when all of a sudden they say, okay, let's start playing. I don't know. That's my opinion. All right, there I am talking sports, and I, as I say that, I totally don't even care. So what are you going to do? Okay, we have a very interesting guest today, and it's a fairly lengthy guest. He's an author, and he used to be a gang member, a motorcycle gang, you know, nothing, didn't murder people or anything. But this interview is very interesting because it shows how the gang-like mentality actually filters itself into our lifestyles as non-gang people and into our politics. This interview took place when Trump was running for president, when he was still part of the, you know, the nominating campaigning process. So that came up a little bit in this interview with this particular author. But it's I found it fascinating, and I'm going to repeat it today because I am a little tired. I did not get much sleep last night, so you'll have to excuse me. I'll be back in full swing tomorrow. But this is a very interesting interview, very really, really interesting stuff. So let's say hello to Tom Skorda, who is the author here. He's a fascinating man. We'll do that right after these words.
Gentlemen, you know that when you decide to get engaged, you'll be making one of the most important investments of your life. Think about it. From the moment you get down on bended knee and present the ring, how much you actually love someone will be judged solely on the size of the stone you buy. And not just by the one you love, but by literally everyone she knows. And strangers. At Schlickershek the Jewelers, we know that when you're about to cough up what amounts to a few months' rent to obtain the exclusive naming rights to a vagina, you want to be able to be sure that you've made the best choice. So if you've decided it's time to staple gun your man tackle to a single hitching post and to never be able to experience the simple joy of a meaningless hookup without handing over half your stuff, come to Schlickershek the Jewelers and see our amazing line of certified, high-quality, shallow female ego strokers. Take it from me, Herbert Schlickershek. I'm not just your local jeweler. I've been married 6.5 times. Vegas marriages, boys. Very easy to annul when the shrew goes south on you. And she will.
Author Tom Skorda joins us now. He's the number one best-selling author of Franchise Savvy and The Magic of Choosing Uncertainty. His background is quite interesting. Tom, you were just a normal 10-year-old kid, I understand, and wanted to be normal, and then all of a sudden you had a different desire.
Yeah, Ron, that's so true. I lived in New York, and don't hold that against me.
I know. Where were you? I'm from New York.
Okay, I was born and raised in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
In Park section.
I was in Teaneck, New Jersey, and then moved to the city. But go on. So I'm clicking with you. I'm clicking with you. Go on.
Yeah. So, in my neighborhood there was a guy. We used to call him Mike the Bike, and he had this old Harley chopper, and he just impressed the heck out of me, and I just wanted to be like him when I grew up. So at 10 years old, all my friends wanted to play for the New York Yankees, but I wanted to be a Hell's Angel.
Huh. Interesting.
Even at an early age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what drove you in that direction of wanting to fulfill that?
You know, it's just... It's interesting when I think about it now, because it's so many years ago, right? I'm in my 50s now, but it's being a young kid and seeing that everybody had like a visceral reaction to seeing this guy coming down the block, I was like, wow, this is cool. This guy gets a lot of attention. And, you know, then you start reading psychology books and, you know, psychology 101 in college, and I realized that, you know, I was seeking like my mother's attention somehow. By, you know, growing my hair long and getting tattoos,
yep.
And then doing everything against society, and you know, I quit college and joined the motorcycle club in New York City in Brooklyn, and yep. And kind of went down that road, down that subculture.
Hmm. Okay, so then you kind of figured out what gangs are about, because I know that at a point you had left that, and then you became kind of a motivational kind of person for other people. Why did you actually leave the gang atmosphere?
Well, you know, I got into it kind of by accident. I was just hanging out. You know, you hang around. You know, whatever you are, you kind of attract those kind of people to you.
Yeah.
And so here I am riding this old 1947 Harley chopper and hanging out in biker bars. And I met a couple of guys, and one thing led to another. And I met this club, and kind of just fell into it. And the stories go deep in my book that I'm actually currently writing. Which is a life lesson from a motorcycle gang. You know, I talk more deeply about it, but for the sake of time, I kind of got sucked in, and I wanted to get in because I thought it was all about, you know, drinking beer and partying and riding motorcycles and having a good time. But then I realized the guys that I was hanging around with were really into kind of a lot of violence, and I wasn't a violent guy.
Really?
And I was more like a lover. I wasn't a fighter.
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, I was in it, and once you're in it, you really can't get out. There's really only two ways out: death or jail. You know, it's kind of like the mafia in a lot of ways, but you know things about these folks, you know, that nobody else knows.
Huh.
And so I realized that this life was not for me, and I wanted to, you know, be a regular guy. I wanted to, you know, just get married. Sometimes, like when you hear celebrities, when they make it rich and famous, they realize, man, I just wish I had a job and I was a regular guy and I could have a regular life.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't have a regular life. I couldn't just go into a restaurant and just have a, you know, be a normal guy, because I really stuck out like a sore thumb. And in a way, it was kind of like being a celebrity, where, you know, we would be, you know, drinking beers on the street in Greenwich Village and people would be asking to take pictures with us.
Oh, interesting.
And that was part of the draw for me as well.
Our lay impression of being in a gang would be people that are maybe somewhat lost, that want to be accepted by a social entity.
And
then you can even take that and go further with this ISIS thing. Is that not just a religious gang?
Wow, you know, man, that's insightful.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we talk about that a lot. I work with a guy by the name of Scott Mann. He's a former Marine and Green Beret. He was over in Afghanistan, you know, dealing with everybody over there. And he came back. He wrote a great book about how to deal with this ISIS issue and really terrorism in general. Colonel Scott Mann, and you should check out his book. And really what he talks about there is that talking to these folks, you know, they're not on the same level as us. They're thinking like barbarian.
Right.
They're not thinking about, I'm going to sue you and I'm going to call my lawyer. That's
right.
The way we think.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk it all out. These guys are not into talking. They're all into a you know, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That's how gangs are. Very barbaric. You know, you stepped on my turf.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You insulted me. I look bad in front of everybody. Now I have to do something to you to prove that I'm a man.
Yeah.
And that's how ISIS operates. That's how gangs operate. Very.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny because I was doing a speech about this gang life. And Scott Mann was in the audience, and afterwards, that's how we met. Came up to me, he's like, "Wow, we need to collaborate."
Interesting.
What you're talking about gang life is exactly what I'm talking about in terrorism organizations.
And let's take it another step further and tell me if you agree. Is there not a politics kind of application to this, where perhaps a politician or someone running for president or something would be like acting tough and saying, "If you feel you're alone and you're not loved, then come into my tough area and no one steps on our toes. And if you do, I'll step on yours." Is there a connotation there too?
I guess you could draw that out in a lot of what's going on today in our, you know, one of the best political races of our lifetime. I think Yeah. Especially if you like situation comedies, that's what it's like.
I know.
But when you've got somebody, you know, you got one person saying, "Hey, if you feel shut out and your wages are low or you can't get a job, come with me because I'm going to help you do all that. I'm going to solve that problem." So I guess you're, and the other guy saying, "If you're not safe, we're going to build a wall. So come inside my wall."
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the way you draw out that logical conclusion into politics probably makes a lot of sense. I never thought about it. Yeah,
especially the mentality of if you attack me, I'll attack you back worse than you can even imagine. It's the same kind of, talking about the eye for an eye thing. And then you took it a step further, which I find also extremely fascinated, beyond even what's fascinating here, is that you take that into the business world, where the business world is also somewhat of it's an endeavor where you need to conquer and to bring people in. And I guess some things can be applied there in perhaps a good way.
Yeah, it really is. But if you think about it, what a company really wants to build is loyal followers.
Right.
It could be the religion of, you know, Apple, the religion of Microsoft.
Yeah.
It could be the religion of Amazon. I mean, we have, so you want to wear their shirt. You want to wear their logo.
Yeah.
You know, it's if you could build a fanatic group and have employees like that, I mean, if you think about it, one of the things I talk about in my book is that one real paramount thing for a motorcycle gang is their logo, right? They call it the colors. So it's the patch you wear on your jacket. And you guard that with your life. It's so sacred that you have it tattooed in your skin if you're a real badass, right?
Yeah.
So imagine if you had a brand where people were so loyal that they would get it tattooed and, you know, get your logo tattooed on their body. I mean, that is the ultimate in branding, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I learned a lot about how gangs and how we kept the brand loyalty so ingrained in our culture day in and day out in the gang, and I draw that out into business. It's an amazing, you know, like, I don't know if anybody ever thought about it like that, but, you know, coming from where I come from, that's what I see.
Well, I mean, your first example of Apple was very interesting because, yeah, you do start wearing their clothing and you do go for their mentality. It's kind of interesting how that becomes very encompassing. You stand online to get their product. I guess that's the goal is to indeed encompass you.
Yeah. Hmm. And it's the same thing with the gang. It's all about, you know, this is who we are. This is what we stand for.
Yeah.
Come in and we'll take care of you. You know, just drink our Kool-Aid instead of the other guy's Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Interesting. Very much like politics.
Very interesting. But, I mean, in some aspects, I guess, organizations can do good when they bring people in. It's just if they indicate to you that we're going to replace your family, then I guess that's not a good clue.
But, well, that's when it becomes pathological.
Yeah.
And you know, in our little thing, you know, we always try to keep family involved.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even like if you ever watch any of the old, you know, gang movies, whether it was The Godfather or Goodfellas, they always talk about, you know, you got to be a family guy. You always have to have family. That's the most important thing.
Right.
And it's still true. I mean, even in the gang, we had family picnics and, you know, we have pictures of kids on motorcycles and things like that.
Yeah.
It is still part of that culture. So it doesn't go to the point where it becomes a cult.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the next step a little bit. And, you know, that might be more like ISIS, where you're picking up and moving to Syria or wherever the training camps are these days. And you're leaving everything behind and, you know, you join a cult like, you know, Charles Manson's family or something. That's a little bit more than what I am talking about in a gang.
I got you. Yeah, it becomes psychotic, yeah. You can do that on your own. You don't need a gang to be psychotic.
I guess,
I suppose. So you're...
Right, you can just
Yeah.
He could just run for president.
Ah, hey, that apparently works for, they think it works for some people. I don't know. So, but your lure originally was indeed the love of motorcycles, and it may be a little bad boy in there somewhere, but, I mean, you legitimately loved Harleys, right?
Yeah, it was started from an early age, and it was just, I loved the old style choppers with the long front ends, yeah, and the high handlebars, and yep, the kind of stuff that you would see even on, like, the old TV show Sons of Anarchy.
Yep. Yep.
And you know, I just love the, you know, and it's become an art form, especially with the past 10 years with the various TV shows on cable, like Orange County Choppers and things like that. And I actually have books on the art of motorcycles. You could go to museum exhibits, yeah, on these old Harley choppers. Yeah. They actually show them as pieces of art.
I got you.
And so they were. And a motorcycle, you know, when you're kind of in it, in that subculture, yeah, a motorcycle is really part of the family.
Yeah.
Everybody knows its history. It shows up in photos in the family album. It, yeah, has a place, you know, where it takes its naps, you know, in the garage. Yeah. I mean, everybody knows where it is, and everybody knows what's happened to it. And, you know, a really good biker knows when it's not feeling well, right? You could feel that the vibration of that engine is not right. And you could hear it not right. And even to this day, even though I don't ride motorcycles and I fly planes instead because that's more dangerous. But
okay, good.
Just the other day we were driving on the highway and I heard this Harley coming up behind us and I was like, something is wrong with this guy's engine. And as he passed us in the left lane, you could see all this white smoke coming out. I was like, yeah, he has an oil leak. He has an engine leak.
Yeah, so so you have a love of the item, as many people do working on cars. I mean, I get that. So that's a book that you're working on now. Do you have anything in your mind release date wise or how far along this is?
You know, I'm the kind of person that, like, when I'm in the mood, I'll write a couple of chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I hope to get it out probably in this time next year. Probably in a year, I'll get it out on shelves or cool, Amazon. I have two other books out there that really, one is just totally, you know, my stories about the pros and cons of franchising and, you know, owning a business,
mm-hmm,
the lessons I learned, the mistakes I made, all that stuff. And one is called The Magic of Choosing Uncertainty, which is really kind of a labor of love where it's really all about making, you know, every life decision that we have, Ron, is the choice between uncertainty or unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to work with people to choose, choose that uncertainty because that's where the magic happens.
Yeah, it seems like the road, the way that you describe it with your background and being the entrepreneurialism is everybody makes mistakes, and if you don't try, you have to make mistakes when you're trying, but the trick is to learn from the mistakes that you made. I guess that seems to be the running thread here.
Yeah, it's definitely learning from your mistakes. Be willing to take a chance. Mm-hmm. If you don't take a chance, you'll never achieve anything. You'll have no, you know, I read something years ago by Jim Morrison, the guy from the rock
Doors.
Band The Doors,
yep,
with those people that don't know, mm-hmm, that music.
I know. Isn't it interesting that you actually have to explain that now?
it really is. You know, what's the old joke? It's like Paul McCartney was in the band before Wings.
Yes,
oh my goodness,
exactly.
I didn't know that.
That's freaky. Go on.
Yeah, it's
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
You know, I read that thing with Jim Morrison said, is your life enough to make a movie about?
Mm-hmm.
And I always had that idea in the back of my mind. And I realized that at the end of the day, you know, as we all know, we're here for a microsecond in world history.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do you got to lose, really? And we're so brought up with fear. You know, the last thing your mom always said to you when you were leaving the house is, be careful, right? Yeah. So you went through your whole life being careful.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's sad. And then we wake up one day, we have a midlife crisis. I call it a midlife awakening.
Yeah.
And you're like, man, I don't like what I'm doing. I got to do something different.
Yeah.
And, you know, people get divorced and all sorts of stupid things happen because they don't understand why it's happening.
Yeah, I know. It's great. It's fascinating talking to you. The books are Franchise Savvy and The Magic of Choosing Uncertainty, and there's another Baby in the Oven. I mean, that's not the title. I mean, I'm just saying.
There's another Baby in the Oven, the working title now is The 5 Lessons Learned from Being a Member of an Outlaw Motorcycle Gang.
Oh, cool. If you want to visit him and follow him, his website is tomscarda.com, TOMSCARDA.com, and you'll always find something interesting going on there. Hey, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, Tom.
Thank you, Ron. This has been a pleasure for me, my honor.
Good. I look forward to speaking to you when we get close to the book release.
I definitely will let you know and we'll talk about it.
Cool.
Sure.
Pleasure. You take care.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park. And then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo. Then later, a movie too, and then home. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep. Just a perfect day. Problems all left alone. Weekenders on our own. It's such fun. Just a perfect day. You made me forget myself. I thought I was someone else, someone good. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep me hanging on.
Well, there's your show for today. I will be back tomorrow with a brand new show. I'll be back in full swing. Until then, I wish you peace. 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 I wish you peace.